Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Hey everyone, it's Matthew Zachary, and welcome back to Out of Patience. What was once a show is now a party, right here on the same feed you already subscribed to. Why? Because I'm now the ringleader of a whole new cast of senior correspondents with segments featuring opinion pieces, rants, and the latest news about the shit show that is our fabulous healthcare system. The only thing that hasn't changed is our mission to make healthcare suck less for everyone. Let's get started. Hey guys, welcome back. My God, what a great show I had today interviewing Dr. Lishan Aklog. He's a thoracic surgeon. He knows the doctor that helped my dad live after his triple bypass, like such a karmic moment to meet a man that knew the guy. He's the chairman and chief executive officer at PAVmed and Lucid Diagnostics, and this show is all about this brave new world of technology and diagnostics to a point where it's now possible to never get certain cancers in the first place at all. Now that's progress. He fled political violence in Ethiopia as a young teenager. He's held people's hearts in his hands. He knows Dick Cheney has no pulse. We'll get to that funny part of the show. We talked about what keeps him up at 3 a.m, why he started this company, what his passions are. And then, of course, we dig into things like getting a drug to market, getting a diagnostic. How do people know it's possible to not get something they don't want? Like, I don't know, cancer? He's also one of the top 50 healthcare technology CEOs of 2021. And my God, what a story. This guy's a human being. He's got empathy. And not that you want to see a cardiac thoracic surgeon in your life, but if you do, he's the guy. Enjoy Dr. Lishan Aklog. Here we go. Lishan, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Long time.
I think years, yeah.
It's about 2 years.
Yeah, we've been trying to connect for a while.
Special shout out to Sean O'Neill.
Yeah, we had a little pandemic to deal with and a few other factors.
What? Wait, did something happen?
Earth is...
I must have missed this stuff.
Trying to end and things, yeah.
George Carlin does a great bit about how we're here to save the planet, but the planet's going to be fine with that. We're the ones that are fucked, not the planet.
Exactly.
So much for that.
Exactly.
I'm thrilled to have you here because I'm on this hell-bent quest to better understand how the hell society can do a better job reaching the people that need to know shit they never thought they knew they had to need. And that all is about an intervention that you never expected to have.
Correct.
And we're going to get to preventative care because that's like the whole, can you not get cancer? What a great conversation to have.
Exactly.
Progress from like the three drugs I had back in the 90s. But let's start with like, all right, you are like an acclaimed cardiac, amazing human being person. What got you, like choosing medicine makes sense, you want to help, but was there a passion there that started from something else?
It was a bit of a meandering path. So I was a complete math and science nerd, really math and physics. And I had my father was a very prominent physician in Ethiopia. I grew up in Ethiopia and he was the first cardiologist there. He was just a very prominent guy. And everyone assumed, well, chip off the old block, Lishan would follow in his paths. And I had no interest in that. And I was going to go off and be a high energy particle physicist. I spent time in Fermi lab when I was a young kid and was a bit precocious when it came to math and science. And I just eventually found that, and a lot of this is from my father's experience. I went back to Ethiopia one summer and basically hung out with him and all of his prominent physicians. And and decided that, you know, I had to do something. I had to really work in an area where I had interactions with people and was able to help them. Yeah, it was a little bit corny sort of medical school application thing, mm-hmm. but that's where we ended up.
Did you have a I'm so sorry Fermi party?
I looked around and, you know, when you get to upper echelons of physics, you run into some weird characters. And I looked around. I was like, I like the science here, but this is I don't see myself showing up to work every day.
Sounds like the squad you were meant to be a part of.
Yeah, exactly.
So I stalk all my guests and I do all the research and all the homework and yeah, I've had a lot of guests on the show who are in medicine who basically fled and were refugees. I don't think that was your case in particular.
It's funny. I don't think of it that way because I joke, and I'm sure, you know, the people I work with, you know, sort of roll their eyes when I say this. But I still think like a physicist. And even though I've left medicine and now I'm on the business side, I operate, no pun intended, as a surgeon. So my mentality and my kind of psyche is very much the same as it was when I was trying to understand the origins of the universe and things like that.
I mean, I had a colleague on the show actually last week who came over from Niger, mm-hmm. and she was a refugee. She came over at like 12 years old with her family, and you know, her dad was an engineer in Niger, and he had to wind up working in like a steel mill.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you're talking about the immigrant side of things. Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was I left at 13. My parents literally put me and my older sister on a plane and says, you're going to Naperville, Illinois to live with some American families because of political violence that was really bloody and getting out of hand in Ethiopia in the late 70s. And yeah, landed in O'Hare Airport, met the family for the first time. There's a little piece that I wrote in the Wall Street Journal when there was all of the anti-immigrant stuff back in 2016 describing this and left the airport and they said, well, are you hungry? Do you want to eat? I'm like, sure. Then what do you want to eat? And I said, apple pie. And literally with no sort of understanding of the irony of it and all that. And we, before we even went to the house, we stopped at Pop and Fresh Pies in Ogden Avenue in Naperville, Illinois. And that was my first meal on arriving.
Not apples to apples. See what I did there. But in like an Iron Man, when he's captured, he comes back. I need a cheeseburger.
Yeah,
just
exactly.
Give me a cheeseburger.
Exactly. Right. Couldn't have scripted it any.
So that got you into this track of what I would do now.
Right. So I, you know, I mean, I was here in America, I had the opportunities. I mean, I wasn't culturally, I had amazing teachers back in Ethiopia. I was actually pretty advanced already. I had I went to American schools. And so I came in with a solid background, but obviously the opportunities that were provided to me by this country are just indescribable, both, you know, starting with these families who brought me in as a son and as a family brought me as a son, and then opportunities I got along the way in terms of getting a great education and having the opportunity to go do amazing things in medicine and surgery and heart surgery and now what I'm doing now.
My father had a triple bypass like 6 or 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I forget the name of the doctor, but it was the same guy that did Clinton's.
It was Craig Smith.
Yeah, Craig
Smith at Columbia. Yeah,
that's
amazing,
right.
An amazing human being.
Worship that man.
Yeah.
Hey, he saved my dad's life, but it's like, I hold your heart in my hand.
Yeah, he is just a gentleman surgeon, brilliant, you know, a real doctor. A lot of surgeons are not, you know, are sort of see themselves as technicians.
The man had empathy. He cared. He came out and asked questions. He spent time.
He had a thing in the peak COVID in the first couple of months where he was writing these essentially blog posts. He's a surgeon, but he was talking blog posts about the disease and about the sort of the drama and the human suffering. And a lot of it was started to get people sort of who were in the trenches and just, you know, getting hammered in those first couple of months. And it kind of spread. It went viral, and we used to just read it every day. And we all know him, so it was just an amazing thing that really demonstrated that empathy and that humanity. So your dad had a good doctor, good person, as
like,
well as a good surgeon, as well as a great surgeon
in the world.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. That's amazing.
He's still here. He's very happy. He writes him a card every year.
Yeah,
still here.
I get those. I get cards from people I operated on 20 years ago.
Somehow open heart surgery anniversary.
They track me down and they say, "Here's my 20th. It's been my 20 years since my surgery."
So let's get empathy is such an open ended conversation to have. Let me ask you if this is a fair assessment. Mm-hmm. It's easy to say we've lost empathy in medicine. But is it because human beings have gotten less empathetic in medicine or because the system, quote unquote, has made it nearly impossible to have enough time with these patients in primary care and specialty care where the Hippocrates you wish to practice just cannot be truly invested in.
Yeah, it's a complicated. There's no simple answer to that, but I can tell you that I fall on the a little bit more on the line of physicians blame the system too much. The system is terrible. There are lots of issues that
the
need
system.
To be. Yeah, that there are a lot of things that need to be fixed, right? But there's a lot of whining, and I think a lot of physicians have become just kind of jaded and transactional, and they forget the privilege. You know, used to be that when medicine was sort of the noble profession, it was also a privilege. You know, the privilege to have a job that you could show up to every day, where you know your work is actually, you know, improving lives and at times saving lives, particularly in high-end specialties. And I think a lot of that has been lost just societally and just a whole variety of other things. But that's not to say there aren't, you can see it because there are people like Dr. Smith and others who just exude that every day. And so you can see that contrast. They're working under the same system. They're dealing with the same headaches with, you know, electronic health records and pre-authorizations and all the things that people are constantly, you know, malpractice and all the things that physicians sort of whine about every day, you know, which are real. But there are people who are working under that same system who haven't lost that sense of privilege of being a physician and caring for people. And if you're a heart surgeon, actually holding somebody's heart and stopped and fixing it, which is really the epitome.
That's a strange, terrible power privilege, isn't it?
It's really a mind-blowing thing. And a lot of surgeons kind of move on from that and they just become more technicians. But I do miss that part of it. And I never took that for granted. I mean, the most dramatic for me is people think about heart transplants as sort of technically difficult. They're actually not that technically. Sewing in a heart is not the most technically challenging heart operation. It's crazy.
Yeah, I do this every Thursday.
Yeah, right. But you know, with the bypass surgery that your father had can actually be more tricky than heart transplant. But in terms of the, you know, just kind of the metaphysical sort of power of the whole thing, you know, I'll never forget. You walk in the next morning and you look on the monitor and you see an EKG, you know, the EKG tracing. And the person's up and awake and talking to you, and you think, wow, that's amazing. The humanity, you know, you're looking at a completely different tracing because you knew what it looked like because it was sick and it was very abnormal. And you're sitting there talking to this person who was, you know, really sick and had a end stage heart. And you look up, you look at them, they're like chowing down. You look up, and it's just it never ceased.
Well, the Urkel, did I do that? Shows up.
No, actually, it's not so. Just to be clear, it was not sort of the personal victory there. It was more just, you know,
meta,
just
very meta. Right?
Yeah, like wow, how crazy is it that we have the ability to change these people's lives like that? So that's the privilege part of it that I talk about.
You're the first thoracic surgeon I've had on the show in 300 episodes. So I had to bring up this anecdote, which you may know already. Dick Cheney, valveless mechanical heart. Did you know this?
I did, yeah.
He has no pulse.
He has a HeartMate, yeah. The HeartMate.
Have you seen those?
I've implanted them, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
They work really well?
They work. And it's interesting that, and we're getting better at it. People have been working on artificial hearts since the 1960s. There were two very famous heart surgeons back at Texas Heart Institute that have been working on this for decades. It's not an easy problem to solve. And in the last 20 years, there's been significant progress. And you have these implantable pulseless pumps. I mean, the heart's ultimately
just a
pump.
How do you not have a pulse, right? How does that work when you go to checkups or whatever?
I mean, any kind of plumbing. You don't have to have pulsatile flow. You don't have to have a pump that contracts. That's just how we're designed. I believe he had a heart transplant, but he had that for some period of time. And then as a bridge, which is the most common way those heart devices are used, and eventually got a transplant.
Right.
In the 70s. Yeah.
All right. So you just have to, how do you go through life without a pulse? How does that work when you go to the doctor?
There's a lot. When you take your clothes off and you're in the, there's tubes and wires and things. There's no mystery as
not
to what's
walking around
on
the beach like, oh.
Yeah. But if you did check someone's pulse, there would be no pulse. There's just flow. So
you've been at this a very long time, and you've seen the evolution of medicine and the progress we've made, and quality of life used to not be a thing that mattered to patients, and now it's part of like what is defined as a, quote, outcome.
Yes.
Which is so, I think it's part derivative but part intentional, because what's important to this patient is different than what's important to that patient. How have you seen this from your perspective as it pertains to, I don't want to be here, I didn't ask to be here, I'm terrified, and I don't know who to trust?
Again, there's a lot to unpack there. So the first thing that I think you hinted at, which is an interesting thing to touch on, which is that in medicine, everything has to be kind of formalized and structured and scientific method and so forth. So when you talk about, when normal people talk about quality of life, right, it's like, well, how are you doing? How, you know, how's your life? But when it sort of creeps its way into organized medicine, it's quality of life instruments and surveys and, you know, all this sort of analytic stuff, which is good. I mean, I'm not minimizing. There's useful information to be had there in terms of understanding how to assess the things that we do and be better and so forth. But that's not useful to patients. You know, it's not useful to patients to say, hey, okay, it looks like from what you've told me, your QOL, you know, your score on the – every disease has its own QOL scale, and you know, you're a 6. I'm like, well, what does that mean to me?
Right.
It doesn't mean anything to me. Right? So I do think I think there's addressing it as on an individualized basis is something that medicine probably doesn't do as well. I can tell you, I'll give you one quick example because my 86-year-old mother lives with me and she has a good quality of life, but she has a lot of medical issues that need to be managed and I'm pretty much coordinating everything for her. And I can tell you with her, every decision that is made with regard to her numerous medical problems is actually based on me watching her every day and mm-hmm. understanding, you know, going for a walk with the dog and doing, you know, just, you know, it is truly her quality of life. It's not some number on some scale that was designed and validated, and, you know, in some clinical study.
Right.
So, but she's my mom. So I, you know,
well, she's lucky to have you.
I can be invested in that, you know, but that's sort of an extreme example.
Yeah. For historical context, many of my listeners know this. I've said this ad nauseum on the show. But, you know, in the late 1990s, you're surviving cancer. They're like, you're lucky to be alive, right?
Right.
We don't say that anymore, or do we?
We shouldn't. I mean, I don't, you know, I think we've made frustratingly slow, but certainly some progress in certain aspects. I mean, I've had a couple of, you know, I'm in my mid-50s, and I'm starting to have cousins now who are going through this. I had one cousin who was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, and I told, you know, most of my close family, and that's need to start like figuring out what's going to happen. He had fluid around his lungs, and there's all the bad signs of that, right? And that was 4 years ago. He's in good shape. He's on Keytruda, I think, or some analog of Keytruda, one of these immunotherapies.
And right.
For those of us who've seen this for decades, it's bordering on miraculous. And another cousin recently is a pancreatic cancer survivor.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know. Brutal pre-chemo, a robotic pancreatic resection, another brutal round of chemo afterwards. So the whole time I'm thinking, this is the best we can do.
Yeah.
You know, he almost gave up a couple of times. I had to really just encourage him to just hang in there. And it was brutal. But, you know, no evidence of disease. He's a year, you know, year and a half out. And that was universally in most of my career in practicing medicine was a death sentence, was a true death sentence.
Yeah, but still bringing someone to the brink of death to save their life.
Exactly.
Can we not have to do that anymore?
Exactly. Right.
But that's what we're going to talk about in the second half of the show. So we'll be right back after these phenomenal ABC Family messages from 1984.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
So, from like historical perspective, I was diagnosed 26 years ago with, it was like four drugs. There was surgery and four drugs. Mm-hmm. Now there's 40 billion drugs, which is great progress, but it also makes for very interesting shifts in how people who become patients are treated. But in the case of where we're going to get to what you're doing now, of these miracle drugs and products and diagnostics that exist today, we can find things almost as they start to happen instead of having to wait for it to be something bad. Let's talk about how you left medicine to get into this entrepreneurial role of, is it possible to just not get shit in the first place?
Yeah, I think there are common threads between what you're talking about and what drove me to do what I'm doing now, which is just asking the question of like, why do we do it this way? Isn't there a better way to do this? And I have this story. I think I was in a byline article that I wrote when I was literally a medical student in Boston at Mass General Hospital, helping out on a gallbladder surgery where the surgeon was just doing this surgery out of the 1950s. And I was just like, well, that's interesting, Dr. So-and-so. I've heard you can do a lot of this stuff through scopes and through small incisions. And he's just looking at me, giving me the dirty eye the whole time and said, we could have both crawled in this incision thing. It's just crazy how barbaric this was. And I was just the naive medical student, I'm sure he wanted to swat me from across the table. But he did. He finally chimed in and said, I do it this way because it's how Dr. Churchill taught me how to do it. And I knew what that meant. Dr. Churchill was the chief of surgery there in 1930.
Whoa.
Okay. So he had trained in the 50s. And this was in the late 80s. But that had a huge impact on me. I'm thinking, there was a real dissonance there. And that's when I first started this kind of built into my psyche in medicine, which is looking at kind of everything we do, little things, big things, and then think about how can we do it better? Why do we do it this way and how can we do it better? And that's a sort of a common thread that, like you said, my cousin, thank God he's alive, but God, there's got to be a better way to do that than to put him through, near
Well, and your mom, and your mom's lucky to have not just you, but you. Right. You know the ropes. You know the system. Our dear friend Joe Abdo has a great story where his mom had multiple myeloma and she's confronted with all these choices. And Joe happens to know the game. He knows the trials. He knows how to speak the language. And he's telling his mom's doctor about what she should be on. And the doctor doesn't even know these treatments exist.
Yeah.
How do we solve for that luck of having to be lucky to have Joe as your caregiver or you as your mom's caregiver? And in my case, my uncle told me not to do chemo because it would have put neuropathy back in my fingers and I was a concert pianist. So that's the luck part.
I think I'm going to be the cynical Gen Xer. We just have to have better doctors and better systems and people who understand. Like, my mom has great doctors, but to navigate and coordinate, you push here, you squeeze there. I mean, everything she has is very intertwined. Mm-hmm. And nobody but me understands the sort of the nuances of how it all interacts. It's just nothing against them individually, but the system doesn't really allow sort of this integrative approach. And again, she has me, so I can do that. So I think it's a combination of doctors being more committed to that and having systems and using modern technology, using data and records and digital health platforms and other things to facilitate and better coordinate care. So we have a long ways to go with that.
So 6 years ago, I think happy anniversary coming up soon, you started this company called PAV Med.
Correct.
It was like a Dungeons & Dragons dice roll to get that title. How'd that happen?
I played Dungeons & Dragons.
I know, I figured.
I was a math nerd, remember, in high school. I was a D&D guy.
So where'd the name come from?
Oh, that's interesting. So prior to PAVMed, the first chapter in this enterprise was an entity called Pavilion, Holdings Group.
And that say was, no more.
Yeah. So that was me and the two other co-founders. And we'd started this entity. It was basically a holding company that had that functioned. And we decided to start and spin off individual medical device companies. And we were doing that while one of the other physician, the other surgeon of the group, we were practicing full time. And so that's where it came from. Pavilion was intended to sort of describe a,
got it.
You know, Pavilion with lots of stuff in it. You know.
And it's really grown. You're acquiring businesses. Is it fair to say that the general gist of the products and the services and the diagnostics that this company is going to bring to market are to help people catch illness before it becomes an illness, or catch it early enough when it's not going to kill you?
It's actually broader than that. Okay. So let me see if I can describe it. And it's evolved. It's actually broadened in directions that we didn't fully anticipate, which is one of the things I'm proud of, because we structured and built the foundation to allow us to be nimble and to pounce on technologies and opportunities. So broadly speaking, what we decided, prior to PAVmed, we had done single product companies. We said, okay, we have a better way to suck blood clots out of the, you know, large blood clots out of a patient's lungs or their heart, you know, long 2 feet clots without open surgery, which is what we used to do. That was the sort of good example of figuring out a better way to do things. I used to do open heart surgery to pluck out blood clots from the lungs and said, this is crazy. We're like cracking this person's chest. There's got to be a better way to go in with some kind of a catheter and suck the stuff out. So that's how we'd done single product companies. And we said, look, we have a business model. We have this, you know, just to pat ourselves on the back a little bit, me and Brian, the chief medical officer, have a bit of a unusual aptitude for understanding the clinical side and the commercial side. You know, like what is it going to take to take something that actually can be valuable as a commercial product? And so we, you know, had the audacity to say we're going to start this company from scratch and we're going to be a diversified medical technology company from scratch, not focus on any not be pigeonholed into you know, cardiovascular, which is where our sweet spot is, and orthopedics or anything else, but to say that we're going to build an infrastructure where we can access the public markets, so we have access to public capital, and be able to advance products, cutting-edge technologies, disruptive products, not sort of better widget products, but really truly disruptive products across the spectrum in a way that benefits patients broadly. So that's where I'm going to get to your point. So sometimes it's in preventing or picking things up in an early disease. Sometimes it's doing things less invasively with less trauma and less risk for complications. Sometimes it's doing it more cost effectively so the resources in the system can be applied to other things. So we took a pretty broad vision as to what the kinds of technologies that we were looking to develop. What I was saying earlier was that we didn't realize how broad it would be, because initially we were focused on what we kind of knew, which were medical technologies, tools that we use in surgery and interventional care, and trying to come up with better ways to do that. But because we had structured the company the way it is, when we had an opportunity to license technology in molecular diagnostics to identify esophageal precancer, something which we really had little contact with since I was in medical school, we had a structure where we could say, wow, this thing has been, you know, published in Science. We got a call from a person who runs University Hospitals Cleveland, and he told us his faculty had some amazing technology in this space. And we sort of hesitated a little bit, and we said, look, let's expand our footprint to not just include medical devices.
So you nimbled yourself.
Exactly, right.
Into esophageal.
And I'm really proud of that, because we know there were other larger named companies that were sniffing around. And I think I'm proud that we got it, but I also think we did a better job than a larger, less nimble company would be, because we had something on the market within a couple of years.
So let's focus on that one thing, because sure. I think from a relatability perspective,
sure,
we can focus on this one specific
Absolutely.
Thing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say it in Matt language, and you'll say you're wrong, you're an idiot, and say it this way. But so let's say, and I only know this because of our friend Joe Abdo, mm-hmm, kind of explained this to me from like a flowchart perspective.
Sure.
You're eating too many beans and you're going to Chipotle too much, not a sponsor, and you get GERD. Everyone's got GERD. Prilosec, not a sponsor. You know, whatever the hell it is you're on. And hopefully you see a GI or a doctor every now and then, and you get an endoscopy over 50. Maybe you want to do these things because you think there's some normal preventative care. But now there's some kind of, I'm going to say, some kind of test you get either during or after your endoscopy, and they run some genetic tests and screenings, and they say, you know what, you, Mr. Bushbaked Beans, not a sponsor, You should either stop eating these beans or go on this medicine because you might get esophageal cancer. And now we have a way to help you not get it.
Okay. So you started off on the right foot, but then you veered off in a direction that's actually, it's way worse than that.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'm glad I started light.
Yeah, you started off fine, but the tragedy of this, of the situation we face, and you know, when you talk about the things that you focus on, there is no better example in my mind in medicine of a sort of tragic, all deaths are tragic, but tragic deaths from a cancer that is eminently preventable with technologies that we have and tools that are available to us. I'm saying this not because it's my family, but I truly believe, you know, we have this cancer moonshot the proposal that the administration has put forth and a lot of emphasis on, you know, high-minded goals with regard to cutting cancer deaths. I really don't think there's any area of cancer where we have the opportunity to have a bigger impact than in this condition. So let me start with where you started and kind of aim it in that direction. So you're right. There are dietary contributors to acid reflux, GERD, the things you described, right? But it's more than that.
Only because, I can name the consumer brands.
Because it's more than that. Because people in the 40s and 50s and 60s were also eating like crap, right? Yeah. It's not like they were eating kale and you know and healthy food.
Yeah, there was no kale in the World War II food packets.
Yeah, exactly. So look at a TV dinner from the 50s, right? So there is some other fact, something else going on that has led to an explosion in the number of people who have a lot of reflux, GERD. We'll just use the term GERD. GERD is gastroesophageal reflux disease. Mm-hmm. If you take just say every week I have these symptoms where I eat and I lay flat, or in other situations I get heartburn. I get this pain that almost feels like a heart attack. And I might take Mylanta, I might take Prilosec or something over the counter and maybe keep it in check. But it happens every week. There's 50 million people with that. One in four adults in this country have what we call chronic GERD, mm-hmm. at least once a week. That's a lot. What they don't realize, so you said they go see a GI, maybe this, they have no idea about any of that. There's nothing on their radar about getting that checked. The only thing that what we pound into people through TV advertising and so forth is you're having heartburn, you're burping, take this purple pill and it'll go away, right? That's mm-hmm. all we tell people.
Right.
On the lay
Eat
side.
All the beans you want.
Yeah.
Make
right.
the pill go.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Correct. And it's not that much better on the medical side, right? So a typical, these people do not see a gastroenterologist. Not 50 million people seeing gastroenterologists. They might see their primary care physician, or they might have a primary care physician. They see their primary care physician and it never comes up.
Right.
They go to their primary care physician. They talk about their cholesterol and this and that, you know, your blood pressure and, you know.
And if they're not on a prescription, you never know they're doing OTC.
No, because it's OTC and it might be on the list of problems, but they never get to it unless it actually, the symptoms are difficult to control. Mm-hmm. So if you're like, you know, if you're keeping it in check by popping your Prilosec, it's not even going to come up in your interactions with your primary care doctor.
Right,
forget
right.
about a gastroenterologist.
So we're stages away from a specialist.
Okay. So, but what is the consequence of that? What happens with reflux is the stomach fluid, acid, and bile in your stomach end up in your food tube, in your esophagus, the downstream part of your food tube. And that part of your food tube is not, your esophagus is not designed to be exposed to acid. As you might imagine, the lining of your stomach is specifically designed to
not
handle.
Not a fabulous place to rent some space.
Exactly. So it's looking here and saying, what is all this acid? Man, this is, you know, this is really not supposed to be here. I better change my lining to look more like stomach or to, you know, intestine, so I can handle this acid. So it's a really kind of an attempt at, like in a lot of things in health medicine, an attempt to kind of accommodate this abnormal signal.
Right.
Anytime you try to accommodate an abnormal signal and try to do things differently in your body, your cells can mess that up. So the process of, it's called metaplasia, where the lining of the cells are trying to change in response to the stimulus. And that leads to this condition that in itself is a condition called Barrett's esophagus, which is an esophageal precancer. So patients, consumers, most primary care physicians do not understand the relationship between GERD and esophageal precancer. It's just not on their radar.
That seems so like antediluvian.
It's crazy. Yeah,
yeah.
It is nuts. I mean, if you know, when we talk to primary care physicians, we bring it up and like, oh yeah, I do remember medical school. We talked, there was this, Barrett's, I guess I remember that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of Their focus is on symptomatology, and they do not send patients to primary care physicians, to gastroenterologists, unless they have severe symptoms. Mm. That's a little bit shocking, but the tragic part of it is that if you pick up esophageal precancer, so you can have early stage precancers, which is this metaplasia where the cells are just looking a little bit abnormal, you know, they're modifying themselves, and then there's dysplasia, which is very common in many other cancers, cervical cancer, breast cancer,
right.
There's dysplasia where you're just on the verge of actually becoming mm-hmm. cancerous, right? Those precancers, we have all the elements to deal with them, to prevent them from progressing to actual cancer. You can monitor people who have the earlier stages by doing an endoscopy on a regular basis, just like you get a colonoscopy, right? And check to see if you're progressing along the spectrum. And then if you get into that dysplasia phase where you're not quite a cancer, we have a treatment that's available to patients where through an endoscopy, you can do an ablation and basically clear out the abnormal cells and reliably prevent people from progressing to cancer. Very similar to what happens with a Pap test. So a patient with cervical dysplasia because of
right.
HPV or some other thing, there's some abnormal cells. You do the Pap test, you're like, there's a little bit of abnormality there. You track it. If you get dysplasia, you can do a localized ablation type procedure.
And not get it.
Right. All of those elements have been around for a long time.
Right. So in the vein of let's try to knock out cancer in general, we're going to take one more break and come back with a bonus third segment because I want to wrap this up in a way that gets us really pissed so we can do some cool things to hopefully get in the minds of doctors. This is so obvious.
Yeah, it's simple.
All right. We'll be right back. As someone who was born with a brain tumor, this idea of like, how could I never have got in the first place? If there's a way to know that this is a gateway to something else, obviously we've learned that lesson with cigarettes and smoking. I don't think in my Jewish cynicism, we're going to get people to stop eating things that give them GERD.
Because it's all obesity.
We know, this is America.
Until we cure obesity, we're not going to cure GERD.
So I think we get the gist that there's a test now that people can get that'll predict whether they're at risk for esophageal cancer.
It'll predict whether they have precancer. It's not just predicting your risk. It determines whether you actually have a precancer, which can be treated to prevent the cancer.
That's insane.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Just one quick note on esophageal cancer, just to remind people how the tragedy of this is not just that we're missing it, but that esophageal cancer is the second most lethal cancer. It's a death sentence. The story we hear every day is a 55-year-old been taking, popping antacids for 20 years, thought they were fine. They show up with weight loss and anemia, and the GI puts the scope down and says, shit, this person's going to die.
Yeah. I say this with air quotes. Is it as simple as helping primary care physicians just ask the basic question, are you taking any antacids?
It's actually simpler than that because they already know that. It's already in the history. It's already in the electronic medical record. The task that we have right now, as you said, we have a test. We have a molecular diagnostic modern sequencing DNA test that can be performed on a sample that can be collected in less than 5 minutes, 2 minutes. You swallow this little balloon thing, you get these cells come out, they get sent for this fancy molecular diagnostic test, positive or negative, we get an answer. So it's as simple as educating primary care physicians and also consumers and patients that if you have longstanding GERD, you are at risk of having a precancer. If you have the precancer, you're at risk of getting this deadly, deadly esophageal cancer. There is a test that can be done in 2 minutes in an office that can determine whether you have the precancer or not. If you have the precancer, you can be monitored and treated before you develop the cancer and not die of cancer. That's it. That's what we're educating primary care physicians about, is to understand the relationship and understand the availability of a non-invasive test that can pick this up, just like we do with other, mammograms and HPV tests and other tests that we can use.
Or Cologuard. We had the exact sciences team here a couple of weeks ago.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. from from almost like an evolutionary perspective, here's a test you can get that'll put you at risk. I'm sorry. Here's a test you take at home, and it goes to your doctor, and the doctor says, oh, you should probably get a test.
Yes, exactly. It is. It's triaging people and identifying those who should be getting further workup and who are in the system being monitored. We're not going to monitor all 50 million people, right? Our idea is to identify the ones that actually have the precancer so those people can be monitored so we never, ever see them ending up with this tragic cancer. As you said, I'm a thoracic surgeon. I practiced heart surgery, but I trained in general thoracic surgery as well. So I know how gruesome an operation an esophagectomy is. It is not fun. You're basically splitting the person open from stem to stern and taking out their esophagus and pulling up a stomach, and it's just not good.
So, something no one really wants. No. Is this as much a consumer play as it is a doctor play?
So we have both. We've established a direct to consumer channel in Phoenix that we're sort of dabbling in and trying to understand what's effective in getting people to understand this and getting people who have this to understand, to be educated, and to make themselves available. We have a telemedicine service that we work with where people can actually get screened for, determine whether they should get the test. And we have our own test centers that actually, well, where we have our own nurse practitioners will perform it. But the big task is really with physicians, with primary care physicians, understanding the relationship between these two diseases and the availability of a test. And also, to be perfectly blunt, getting you know, we have to run this as a business. So getting reimbursement for that. I mean, we have a big challenge ahead of us. We're working with Medicare. We're working with private payers to get this covered. We had an open meeting with Medicare where Mindy Mordecai, who's one of the leading...
Mordecai, excuse me.
who's an amazing woman, tragic widow of an esophageal cancer, a person who died of esophageal cancer. And just listening to her tell the Medicare folks about, how long they've been waiting for, groups like her have been waiting for.
But that's the story. If only this existed when my ex died from this.
Correct. But she's made it her life's mission to save other lives and to advocate for it. So there's work with regard to advocacy around, with legislators and payers and so forth.
Go to market and market access and that jargony crap is a whole other show.
I know. But so that's what we're working on now. We're very committed to establishing broad availability of this test so people can get it done and have it covered by their insurance.
Is there a simple thing listeners can understand about a role? I mean, what role do consumers or patients play in helping something get approved? Because anyone can march on the FDA and do the little meetings and whatever, but what is it? There's no simple answer, but if there were a simple answer, what can patients who've lost somebody to esophageal cancer that are told, there's a test now, someone else doesn't have to go through this.
They can demand through whatever channels they have, through their legislators, through their companies, through their insurance companies, that the system provides this test so people won't die of esophageal cancer.
Just love the idea of it's possible to not even get it in the first place was unheard of 20 years ago.
Exactly. Right. I mean, that's why I said back then why this is in many ways one of the greatest tragedies in cancer care, because we have one of the worst cancers. We know everything about it. We know who gets it. We can identify those people and we can literally prevent them not just from dying but from getting it. The reason we have to get it in the precancer stage is that if you develop, for example, you mentioned Cologuard. If you pick up a stage one colon cancer, they can pick up some of the adenomas, but they mostly are picking up cancer. You pick up a stage one colon cancer, you can be cured. Pick up a stage one breast cancer, cured. You can stage one cervical cancer, similarly, right? So that's why we have good screening modalities for those. Esophageal cancer, stage one esophageal cancer has a 40% 5-year survival.
Right.
So more than half will die at stage one. So you cannot pick it up. It doesn't help. They have these blood tests now and some of them might be able to pick up an esophageal cancer here or there. It doesn't matter. If you pick it up at one, you're still going to have a 50-50 chance of dying. So that's the difference here, is that we can pick it up in the precancer stage. And it's actually quite miraculous because there really aren't other great examples of picking things up in the precancer stage. So this is true cancer prevention.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, the best example is HPV testing for a
Well, then you just don't get it ever.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you never get it. But that's not common. Mostly we're trying to pick up early stage cancer.
And then there's Gardasil 9, which goes up to 45 years old.
Yeah.
So even if you have it, you're not going to get it.
Yeah, you're just not going to get it. Exactly. Right.
The odds, just the idea of just not getting it is, it's not innovative. It's just why?
It's basic.
It's ridiculous. It's so
pretty
basic.
Yeah.
It's so simple. All right. Well, I want to rile up my base because we're going to challenge everybody to figure out what it is we can do as listeners, as advocates. This just, and I would assume this is almost like a gateway drug to future diagnostics too.
Sure. Yeah. And we, you know, this is, again, this is why we have science, why we advance the fact that we can sequence using NGS, next generation sequencing, genes in minutes or hours. Well, I spent an entire summer of medical school sequencing one gene in the mid-80s. And the fact that we have this incredible technology that we can apply to really practical things today, we need to be, as a system, we just need to, you know, have more streamlined paths so that people can get access. It's not perfect. There are going to be some false negatives. There are going to be some false positives. Every test has those.
But they're better problems to have.
Exactly, because no one is getting it. We're not offering a test that is, we're trying to do better than something else. Like for Cologuard, they're trying to do better than colonoscopy. Nobody is getting an endoscopy right now. So even you know, if you're picking up anybody that you pick up, that you can drive them to a pathway where they're getting proper monitoring and early intervention, is a win. Every single one is a win.
Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. I'm going to show, by the way, another shout out to Sean O'Neill, our friend here, who is yet to be on the show.
You need to bring him on.
Ultimately, shame this man right now to get his ass to New York and come on the show. But Dr. Lishan Aklog, just the fact that you know Craig, my dad's surgeon. I mean, he's 75. He's living large. He's fabulous. Love you, Dad. And he listens to all the shows. It's phenomenal what you're doing, what you've invented. Chairman and Chief Executive Officer and the co-founder of PAVMed, formerly Pavilion something. the name's right. Yeah. And Lucid Diagnostics. I'm going to talk to Sean about Lucid when he comes on the show. The idea of just never getting it in the first place is such a good thing to talk about today compared to just dying of it 20 years ago.
I thanks for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I think the sort of taking the anger approach, you know, of just saying this is not acceptable, is something that I commend you for, because I think the system needs people like you and your listeners to shake things up, and that's, you know, we certainly can benefit from that.
Well, more to come, my friend. Thanks so much. Yeah,
thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Out of Patience with Matthew Zachary is an Off-Script Health production. The executive producers are Matthew Zachary and Andrew McDowell. Our senior producer is Sarah Rosa Davies. It's mixed and edited by Sarah Rosa Davies and Kyle Moore. Special thanks to Brianna Seely for added support. If you like the show, ratings and reviews are always welcome. Leave us a message anytime at 855-AUDIO-66. That's 855-AUDIO-66 to share your healthcare shitness with us, and we might just play them on the air on a future episode. For more information about this show and Offscript Health, visit offscript.com. That's offscript, no T, .com.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.